This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And of course, it's fall, it's autumn, and that's a football weather, we call that. You know, when it gets crisp and cool and we find a nice warm chair to sit in on Sunday morning or afternoon and watch the NFL play, perhaps. Well, a couple of years ago, we saw another bit of a story unfold with the NFL. That's when Colin Kaepernick started taking his knee. He was playing for San Francisco at that time, and he's been unemployed for the last couple of years. We're going to talk about that phenomenon and a new book that sort of explores this issue with Eric Buren. He is a UND history professor, and he joins us from our microphone in Grand Forks. Thanks for being with us, Eric.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
You've just written a new book that was released by the UND Digital Book Press launched just a couple of weeks ago, Protesting on Bended Knee, Race, Dissent, and Patriotism in 21st Century America. So what drew you to this subject for a digital book?
Well, a little over a year ago, I was fishing about for various projects that I was considering, and the Kaepernick protests emerged in a way that resonated with so many people, and I think that's what attracted me to this project. Again, the subtitle is Race, Dissent, and Patriotism, so I think part of the reason why this took on a national significance is that it, again, resonates in so many different ways.
So you call this the intersection of race, the First Amendment, and patriotism, in a sense, this incident and the way we've been talking about it.
Correct.
How did you select the authors of the essays for your publication?
Yes. Well, basically, the book consists of two parts. There's an extended introduction by myself where I situate the Kaepernick-inspired protests against the broad sweep of American history, explaining what's going on almost in real time, as well as having a bifocal perspective against the American past. And then there's 29 short essays written from a variety of perspectives, not just academics like political scientists and philosophers, but also athletes, veterans, coaches. So what we're trying to do is have a contemporaneous account of a nationally significant phenomenon that's viewed in a panoramic perspective.
So what elements of the issue are included in your book?
Well, the way I organize the essays is on some of the essays are organized in such a way that you would see these protests against, again, the broad sweep of American history. Others focus on the law. Others focus on athletes as activists. Still others focus on the kinds of tactics that advocates for change can use. And then there's another section on the kind of counter tactics their opponents use. And there's finally a sixth section that considers the perspectives of others in the arena, coaches, athletes, fans, and others.
So in the course of a year where you've been mulling this project over and then you see these submissions and you put them together in a book, which is available at the Digital Press, and we'll explain how people can get that free in just a moment here. But did any of these submissions change the way you view this issue?
Oh, my gosh. All of them. You know, it's pretty easy to find sort of garden variety takes on Kaepernick and the protests. But what I was particularly interested in were insights that you might not get on, you know, any old typical website. So one of the first things I did was reached out to individuals that I knew would have interesting things to say. So we have an award-winning sports writer here in Grand Forks, Brad Schlossman. I knew he'd have something interesting to say. We've got Hall of Fame coach Mike Berg. I knew he'd have interesting things to say. Same thing with some of the political scientists, philosophers, attorneys. And then as I did my research, you know, expanding the scope to a national realm, if somebody had an interesting perspective, I wanted to get that in there as well.
Well, I was intrigued to see a couple of these. A former NFL player explains why we need more Colin Kaepernick. This is an interview with Chris Cluey, who was formerly with the Vikings. What sort of argument does he make?
Chris Cluey has a very interesting argument. So, one, he sort of contends that given all that they have to risk, especially NFL players, the typical NFL career lasts less than 3 years. They have a particularly weak union, so they have a very small window of opportunity to make money. So given all that they risk, players are probably not lying when they say something's amiss. But I think his argument is doubly interesting, where he says, you know, NFL owners should probably pay attention to this because the players are advocating for changes in a societal structure upon which their businesses, the NFL owners' businesses, rest. If that societal foundation collapses, so does their business.
Well, let's get into a little bit of history here. You are a history professor. Why is the national anthem typically played before athletic events?
Well, that goes back many, many years. But as far as the NFL is concerned, it often played the national anthem. But it wasn't until 2009 that the NFL more or less began to require teams to be out on the field. One of the interesting elements in the story is that the NFL contracted with the U.S. Department of Defense to basically have what Republican Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake described as paid patriotism, military flyovers, soldier reunions, and these sorts of things. And so this is partly the brand that the NFL wanted to create, sort of a militaristic, patriotic image, if you will.
Well, it seems appropriate in a way. Football is kind of quasi-military combat on field in front of people. It's sort of, I guess, in my mind, reminds me of the Colosseum with gladiators and all that kind of stuff. But I wasn't there at that time. What I'm getting at here, though, is the anthem is not played before other kinds of common events. It's not played before a play or a concert or a movie. Why is it before athletic events? That's it.
Again, that's an interesting question that goes back many, many, many decades. The book deals extensively with what we might call anthem protocol or flag protocol, and the ways in which sometimes we abide by these things and sometimes we don't. I think one of the interesting things is, you know, I've never seen somebody stand up during the anthem if they're watching the game at a bar or if they're watching the game at home. So why is it, you know, encouraged in some instances, but not in others?
Well, people are usually lined up at the concession stand, too, while it's playing. I mean, they're all kinds – even at the ballpark, people aren't necessarily standing with their hand over their heart.
One of the interesting elements about that is oftentimes the very owners who wrung their hands over these protests against inequality did not suspend concession sales during the anthem.
Sure.
And so, you know, some would point out as an instance of inconsistency on their part.
So is patriotism intentionally part of the NFL brand?
Absolutely.
And so that makes it a little bit touchy when a significant portion of your team, who share a racial identity that other people don't, start taking a knee, doesn't it?
Yeah, one of the most interesting essays in the collection is written by a pair of sociologists who study the attitudes of NFL fans who are black and the attitudes of NFL fans who are white. And their argument is that there's an inverse relationship between patriotism and the extent to which one is an NFL fan. So the more you are an NFL fan if you're white, the more patriotic you are, whereas if the opposite is true for black individuals. And so their argument is that as NFL fans, black NFL fans, watch these games and they watch these military flyovers and they watch the spreading out of these enormous flags and the NFL basically saying to America, we are a meritocracy, we are patriotic, we are militaristically, public minded, the gap between the NFL fans' reality and what they were seeing on TV grew greater and greater. And these sociologists, you know, say that that chasm between what the NFL was marketing as America and its and the league itself and the reality of these black fans was so great that perhaps something like the Colin Kaepernick-inspired protests were only a matter of time.
Eric Burin is a UND history professor, and he is the editor of a new UND digital book, Protesting on Bended Knee, Race, Dissent, and Patriotism in 21st Century America. You can get it by going to thedigitalpress.org/protesting, and there's a free download there of the PDF of the book. Eric, in the collection of essays, does somebody look at the actual issue of taking a knee? How is that unpatriotic?
There's an extensive conversation about, you know, what it means to take a knee. I managed to work in some of those ideas into my introduction as well. Originally, Kaepernick sat. And then he received some messages, particularly from veterans, who suggested that, you know, this was problematic. And he met with a certain veteran who had once tried to make an NFL team as a long snapper, and they dialogued. And what they came to, the compromise that they came to, was to take a knee. You know, psychologists study, what does it mean to take a knee? Why do we take a knee, say, when one proposes, or why does one take a knee at a fallen soldier's grave? And so they thought this would get the conversation back on track. In Kaepernick's mind, this is precisely how progress evolves. You have a demonstration that raises awareness. That awareness leads to dialogue. Dialogue leads to mutual understanding. And that mutual understanding provides the foundation for change.
Well, Tim Tebow famously took a knee too. Of course, that was after a touchdown or something like that. And he was doing it in a religious sense. But both of these people are taking knees to bring attention to something bigger than themselves, aren't they?
Yes. There's a whole section in the anthology concerning athletes as activists. The idea that athletes, you know, for many, many, many years have used their athletic fame to discuss or promote non-sports issues. And that's true whether you're talking about secular issues or non-secular ones.
Well, political leaders have taken advantage of this, the president in particular, to, you know, force people to pick sides. That is a difficult spot for the NFL to be in.
Yes, the NFL's position was quite complicated. So Roger Goodell, who's the commissioner of the NFL, had a lot of moving parts when trying to resolve this issue. So on one hand, he had 32 NFL owners, team owners, and they had a variety of positions. You had a variety of positions among the NFL players themselves. You had jittery advertisers. You had the players union. And so he was in a tough place. You mentioned President Trump's position on the matter. To me, one of the most interesting elements of the story is that while Trump later turned the protests into his sort of personal political pinata, he wasn't always that way. When Kaepernick first took a knee, Trump was running for president. And of course, he wanted African-American votes, or at least African-Americans, to not vote for Hillary Clinton. So while he took his shots at Kaepernick, he said Kaepernick perhaps should, you know, find a country that suits him better. Subsequently, when Bill O'Reilly, a conservative pundit, had him on his show, Riley asked, you know, if you owned a team and a player took a knee, would you fire him? And candidate Trump sort of took a pass and said, he's simply trying to make a point. I disagree with the point, how he's going about it. And Riley pushed back and said, you know, it doesn't seem like you to pull your punches. And Trump again took a pass, basically saying, let's keep the headlines to a minimum. So Trump's position evolved over time, in part depending on whether he was a candidate for the presidency or actually a president himself.
Well, you are a history professor, and we usually think of that as people, you know, looking back a ways in time to sort of put things in context and all that. But this is history about a current event.
Yes, it's history written in real time. This is a first draft of history, if you will, and I'll confess that there's a small amount of pride in that so many of the authors, not all of them, but many of them, are North Dakotans. This is, again, a first draft of history, with North Dakotans having important things to say about things of national significance.
And the book officially launched on October 16th, which notably was the 50th anniversary of John Carlos and Tommy Smith's famed protest at the 1968 Summer Olympics. And this was not coincidental, I take it.
No, we very much had a historical eye for, frankly, almost every detail we could, even the fonts, the release date, the artwork in the book, all have historical significance.
Well, let's talk about the digital press in this case. It's a means of publishing something pretty quickly, isn't it?
Yes. One of the things that we can do with the digital press at the University of North Dakota is be very nimble and flexible. So the preface of the book starts with Nike's ad featuring Colin Kaepernick. So that ad was released just about when we were going to press. you couldn't do that with a big, colossal, behemoth, you know, press. And so having a digital press makes us a very nimble institution. And it also allows us to broadcast this book for free. Again, people can download the digital copy without charge. We have to pay charge a little bit for the paper copy, which can be purchased on Amazon. But, you know, I'm not making a dime off this, and the digital press is a nonprofit.
Well, it also strikes me that the digital press could probably adapt to changing a changing storyline here. Maybe Colin Kaepernick finally gets picked up by a team. There is a shortage of high quality quarterbacks these days.
Yes, absolutely. One of the interesting elements of the story is that in the sports world, quantitative analysis has really taken over. So perhaps, you know, 15 years ago, somebody would have looked at Colin Kaepernick's statistics, which would have been very rudimentary, and say, you know, is he a good quarterback? Is he not a good quarterback? Well, now with quantitative analysis being so sophisticated, a compelling argument can be made that, you know, he is indisputably an NFL quality quarterback. That doesn't necessarily mean that teams have to take him on, but it means that they're not taking him on in all likelihood because of his activism, not because of his athleticism.
Well, in your collection of essays, Protesting on Bended Knee, do some people take aim at Colin and the means of this protest and pick it apart?
What's interesting about the essays is that very few of them take sides. So, for example, five of the essays consider legal matters. Can the United States government compel people to engage in patriotic exercises? Can a school district dismiss an athlete from a team for taking a knee? So almost all the essays don't say I'm for or against Colin Kaepernick. Instead, they say, you know, what are the legal issues at hand? What are the kind of tactics that advocates for change can use? And again, what are the kind of counter tactics that their opponents can use? So usually there's not yay or nay, but rather a more sophisticated and nuanced analysis of the phenomenon.
Well, I think it's uniquely American in a sense that you have a protest that is itself protested.
Right. And again, I think one of the reasons why this gains such national attention is that it resonates in so many different ways, whether you're talking about racial issues, whether you're talking about, you know, what does it mean to what should be the parameters for dissent? What does it mean to be patriotic? One of the essays, for example, talks about African-Americans who patriotically served during World War I. And so when they came back from fighting overseas, they, you know, wanted equality in America as well. And so, you know, one their tactic, their protest tactic was to flaunt and broadcast their patriotism, that they had served their nation, that their nation should return the favor and bestow them equality. That tactic inspired such a ferocious and violent backlash that 10 African American soldiers were lynched in uniform in 1919 or so. So, one can take a knee, one can protest silently, one can wield patriotism as a tactic. There's almost a countless number of tactical options that advocates for change have, and the same could be true for the counter tactics of their opponents.
Well, the people in support of Colin Kaepernick point out that he's protesting racial violence and not the flag. But the problem is he's doing it when the flag is prominently on display. So can you have it both ways?
Yeah, I think there's at least two elements. On one hand, the protests are about the flag and they are about the anthem because he's using such powerful American symbols to make a point about what he perceives as the gap between what those symbols represent and the reality of African-American life. And so, you know, the second point, of course, is his arguments about systemic racism and particularly incidents of law enforcement officers shooting unarmed African-Americans.
You have in your table of contents one of these essays that caught my eye, the surprising connection between take-a-knee protests and Citizen United by Elizabeth Tippett. What is that surprising connection?
So Tippett is a law professor, and she, you know, discusses the famous Citizens United case, which greatly enhanced corporate speech. And her argument is that a lot of people wrung their hands over what this would mean for our politics, particularly our elections, where corporations would be pouring, you know, tens of millions, if not, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars into campaigns. Her argument is that the enhancement of corporate speech could also potentially benefit the causes that Colin Kaepernick and others support. So if corporations have this ability to wield their financial resources in, frankly, any way they like, they might not confine it to elections, but they might also begin to donate to causes that Colin Kaepernick supports.
It also raises some other kind of important questions, some that we probably don't bring up at work very often. But can an employer require and even enforce specific behavior regarding the anthem, you know, showing your patriotism, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So the First Amendment largely concerns what the government can or cannot do with its citizens. But as you correctly point out, this is more of a employer-employee situation. And of course, there's many layers to it, particularly in regard to the NFL. So Colin Kaepernick signed a contract. That contract requires certain stipulations about what he can and cannot do. There's also a collective bargaining agreement that the NFL Players Union negotiated. The NFL also has a game manual. What's interesting about the game manual is that it says players have to be on the field and they should stand for the flag. So there's many layers to this, whether you're talking about First Amendment issues, whether you're talking about state employment law, whether you're talking about the particular contracts that NFL players sign. At the end of the day, it's not perfectly clear whether or not the NFL could have compelled Kaepernick to stand, but it seems likely that they might have been able to do so.
So the contract can actually limit your First Amendment right if you sign that contract and it isn't tested in a court of law over whether or not the employer overstepped their bounds, huh?
Yes. Many athletes and celebrities and frankly, lots of other people sign contracts that say, you know, you cannot do anything that would bring this corporation into disrepute. And of course, you know, what it means to bring a corporation into disrepute is a vague term, but it certainly gives the leverage on the company side, not the employee side.
But it also reminds us, I guess, that protests exist to get attention.
Right. You know, part of the objective of a protest, and Martin Luther King Jr. discussed this at length, is they're designed to cause discomfort. They're designed to raise awareness. You know, one of the things that's interesting is that Martin Luther King Jr. was less liked in his day than Colin Kaepernick is in ours. You know, it's easy to forget that in the 1950s and 1960s, Martin Luther King Jr. was a rabble-rouser. He was ungrateful. He was divisive. And it's only over the course of time, you know, 50 years later or more, that, you know, we sort of divest him of his radicalism. We divest him of his boldness and frankly, his unpopularity at the time because what he was doing was disrupting things. He was causing discomfort. He was forcing Americans to reckon with what he perceived to be its own sins.
And in the 21st century, Colin Kaepernick is reminding us of that. Eric Burin is a UND history professor, the editor of the new UND digital book, Protesting on Bended Knee, Race, Dissent, and Patriotism in 21st Century America. You can find it at thedigitalpress.org/protesting. Eric, thanks for being with us today.
It's an honor. Thank you very much.
Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern. Sue Balcom joins us to talk about carrots. And Ashley Thornburg and I look at our What's Happening calendar of things to do this weekend. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's tax collections continue to outpace the revenue forecast. The state's Office of Management and Budget reports the September tax collections were $145.7 million, $68 million above forecast. Biennium to date, the revenues are ahead of forecast by 6.2%. OMB Director Joe Morissette says this continues what North Dakota has been seeing over the past few months.
We're over forecast a little bit more each month, and adding to that total biennium to date variance, that positive variance, a little bit more each month. So that's been growing.
Sales tax collections were 52% over the September forecast. Morissette says activity in the oil patch accounted for most of that, and he says it's a good place to be as OMB is starting to prepare for the next revenue forecast, which will be out in December, to coincide with the presentation of Governor Burgum's executive budget to the legislature's organizational session.
We've clearly seen the bottom and have a positive outlook going forward.
Morissette says the Revenue Advisory Committee will be meeting to look at the numbers and will offer its suggestions on what should be in the next forecast. The State Board of Higher Education has tabled any decision about granting tenure to college professors after the Council of College Faculties raised concerns in a letter to the board. Under the proposal, board policy on tenure would be changed so that if an out-of-state candidate for a college presidency is tenured, it could be transferred to the college with board approval. Chancellor Mark Hagerot proposed it.
This is an example of the board finding barriers to recruiting quality people from the outside, and this will give the board the option to give tenure, because the word says may. That's the operative word. The board may award tenure. My strong recommendation is that you would use this tool, but now with this policy change, you will have a policy that allows you to do that.
Council of College Faculty President Deborah Dragseth of Dickinson State University says faculty on all 11 campuses have concerns about this proposal, ranging from financial to collegiality.
We don't see tenure as a perk. We see tenure as something that's very much part of our university process and something that's earned over 7 years.
Board member Casey Ryan moved to table the issue pending more discussion with the faculty members.
We need to come to something that's written that can respect both sides, but also doesn't lock us into creating adversity, which we don't know, it may never show up. But if it does, it will be contentious at that point in time.
The board voted 4-2 to table the issue. And voters in Ward County have been making good use of absentee voting this year.
Absolutely.
Deborah Smested is auditor-treasurer for Ward County.
We've received over 5,000 applications, or we're in the process, and we have a little over 3,000, I believe, returned already.
Smested says with more than 5,000 applications, it puts demand for absentee ballots at or a little above the level of requests during a presidential election year. She says on Monday they will open an early voting precinct at the auditor's office. Smested says when showing up at the polls, make sure you have a valid ID to prove you have been at your current address for more than 30 days. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We like the fact that Main Street doesn't sound like most radio shows, and we'd like to think Prairie Public listeners appreciate that fact. One of the unique parts of our show is the weekly Plainsfolk essay from NDSU history professor Tom Ezern. Tom is focused on the history of the Great Plains, and he loves to write, which is why today's essay, titled Verbing the Plains, pokes fun at our evolving language.
Some friends of mine, who share a common cognizance of native affairs on the Northern Plains, got to talking about a particular usage of language, a case of verbing, that is, of converting a noun into a verb for effect. In this case, the proper noun, Columbus, deployed as a verb, to Columbus. As in, I found this and it didn't belong to me, but I just took it anyway and claimed it as my own. As in, I didn't write this essay, I found it on the internet and Columbused it. Ordinarily, as a writer, I disapprove of perversions of the language, but I like this kind of verbing, particularly when it makes a post-colonial statement on the part of plains folk, when it takes up language as defense of our life on the prairies. In that spirit, I would like to offer some manifestations of verbing for the Northern Plains. In each case, I'll give the term, and then a definition, and then an example of usage. I made these up. None of them are Columbused. Beginning with the obvious, to custer, to gallop heedlessly into a situation, despite good counsel to the contrary, and suffer the consequences. As in, I told him it was a bad idea to plant so many beans this year, but he did anyway. He custered on, and so now he's taking chapter 11. Here's one dear to my loyal heart, to Carson, meaning to carry on heroically, despite pain and suffering, persist, and eventually prevail over all odds. As in, I never saw such a blizzard, but I promised I'd get to my daughter's volleyball match, and so I had to Carson through the storm, and we won. Of course, if I'd gone into the ditch, then I would have been custering and come to grief on account of it. See how this works? Likewise, to cara, to carry yourself with grace and endure countless provocations until finally you've had enough and you call out your persecutors publicly. As in, I've been mayor here for 20 years, and all people ever do is complain about the potholes every spring. It's North Dakota. We have potholes. You people know where they are. Just drive around them till it gets warm enough to patch them. Leave me alone or I'll carry you. Another one, to chasquer, to do one's duty faithfully, but have your actions misunderstood, so that your neighbors turn against you and bring you down. All right, that one is a little obscure. Chasquer was a native scout with the Sibley Expedition of 1863, whom soldiers came to believe had something to do with the killing of their beef contractor, George Brackett, and so they poisoned poor Chasquer, only to discover a few days later that Brackett was alive and kicking. Adding insult to injury, after a century and a half, the state monument for Chasquer, just north of Driscoll, is in a sorry state of disrepair. So, to chasquer, as in, I tried my best, but the rumor mill got started and my so-called friends deserted me. I got chasquered. It happens in prairie towns, you know. Now, I didn't mean for all these verbals to begin with C, so breaking that pattern, here's another one you need a little knowledge of political history to get. To link. To assess the situation we are in, to recognize that we are being overtaken by great forces we cannot stop, nevertheless, to draw a line at some point, take a stand for the sake of posterity. As in what Art Link did in 1973 with When the Landscape is Quiet Again. We need more linking around here today.
That's Tom Easer doing some verbing on the plains. Next on Main Street, Sue Balcom talks about carrots.
Join Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson Friday evening for the final debate in the highly watched U.S. Senate race, with the candidates incumbent Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp and Republican challenger Congressman Kevin Cramer. The debate takes place at NDSU's Student Union and is sponsored by the North Dakota Broadcasters Association. Dave Thompson moderates the final debate in the race for United States Senator from North Dakota, Friday at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and joining us from our microphone in Bismarck, Sue Balcom.
Sue joins us once a week to talk about food. Sue comes to us from the Root Cellars Farm outside of Mandan. Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Nothing more fun than food, right?
No, I think you're pretty much right there. And this week you want to talk about carrots. And this is a food that's good, especially out of the garden. It's better. And then you wait for a frost and then eat them, and then they're just even better still.
Much sweeter. And raise your hand if you've ever eaten a carrot with dirt on it.
Yeah. Well, this is radio,
but my hands,
just say, yeah.
we're all raising our hands here.
Okay, good.
All across
good.
North Dakota, they're raising their hands right now.
I was at my community garden plot, and my son showed up. He did irrigation or lawn sprinkling service, and he had a couple guys with him. And I'm pulling carrots out of the garden in the fall, and I'm offering them to these young men. And the only one that took it was my son, because I'm sure they were a little leery that there was dirt in the cracks of that carrot. But I never peel my garden carrots. We do just kind of brush off that dirt, you know, use a little vegetable brush and some running water. And I love raw carrots, and they're sweeter, much sweeter after the frost, which is, I think that I usually leave my carrots in the ground because they keep better in the ground. So you can keep them in there just like you do beets and potatoes until you can't chip the ground away from them anymore.
So your root cellar is right where the roots are.
Absolutely. So that is – and that's part of the local food challenge in this state. People are always like, I don't know how you can eat local food year-round. Well, part of it is understanding that you can – leave these crops that are cold tolerant out in the garden, cabbage, potatoes, beets and carrots, squash, until you absolutely have to bring them in, like a hard freeze. And there's a difference between a frost and a hard freeze, because a hard freeze, of course, will kill off everything and then things will actually be frozen, as in your deep freeze. But frost is our friend when it comes to things like carrots.
Let's talk about storage, because this summer I was at my in-laws and I was eating some carrots, and I remember thinking, oh, these must be from her garden because these are really wonderful. And not only were they from her garden, but they were from her garden from last summer's harvest, and they lasted a year, or almost a year.
Properly stored in our house, we can eat. We usually have the last of the carrots for Easter dinner in March or April.
Yeah.
They last that long, and here's how we do that. We actually wait until we can't possibly leave them outside any longer, dig them up, brush the dirt off of them. I don't like water. Water breaks down cells, which causes them to rot faster. So we kind of like brush them off or use a old rag or your gloves, your garden gloves, and kind of get rid of the dirt as much as you can. And then trim the tops down to about an inch above the top of the carrot. Then line them up in a bag with some paper towel to keep them a little bit dry, you know, absorb the moisture. And then I store them in the refrigerator, which we keep a second refrigerator in our root cellar specifically for some of the extra juices and things like carrots that we keep all winter long. Just stick them in there, 40 degrees or a little lower than that, and you can eat carrots anytime you want, if you can con your husband into cleaning them for you.
What about all those tops you've hacked off?
Well, you know, there are people who actually make pesto out of carrot tops. And I mentioned this earlier that when I'm out in the garden, I'll eat anything that's out there, just free game when I'm hungry. So carrot tops have a kind of carrot flavor, but kind of a green flavor, too, that you could actually whir up in your blender with a little olive oil and garlic and salt and make a pesto out of them.
And they're really good to just toss in if you're making like a fruit smoothie, too, and just, you know, sneak in some more greens.
And if you have it right, and if you have a juicer, of course, you can juice your carrots and whir all that stuff together, and you'll be getting a double whammy from those carrots.
And carrot juice is so good.
It is wonderful, and it's really wonderful when you grow your own carrots. I have three rows of carrots, three 20-foot rows, and one of them is purple. And so there are people in the world that, you know, they're like, what is that in that bowl over there? Well, that's carrots, man. Carrots never used to be orange. Carrots were every color of the rainbow before humans got their hands into the seed and started crossing them until they got an orange carrot. Now, I don't know why they picked orange, except maybe bunnies liked orange. I don't know.
Probably for transportation.
Does a purple or yellow carrot taste different than an orange one? Is the flavor note in carrots just a variation of sweetness? How would you describe that?
Right. That's exactly right. So you have carrots that haven't been frosted, and you have carrots that have been frosted. And then you have different, like my purple carrots grow to be quite large. But the flavor is carroty. And so there are some shorter carrots, like if you gardened in a box instead of in a big old plot, you could grow a Nanti carrot that is short and fat, or you can get those long, slender, beautiful ones that they just vary, just like you said, with sweetness. But for the most part, they still all taste like carrots. The thing about the purple ones, though, of course, is like I make a hot, spicy, pickled carrot. And if you use the purple ones, of course, then that purple, just like beet juice, will bleed all over the place and stain. And there are some purple carrots that turn this most gorgeous orange when you cook them. But I have a variety. I think they're called Purple Haze. And my daughter, of course, is like, yeah, right, you'd be growing purple haze carrots
I think we just learned a lot about Sue's personality.
That's a historical reference. Yeah.
Okay. And those suckers stay purple through and through. So. Uh-huh.
Well, go back to this hot, spicy carrot. How do you make this hot, spicy, pickled carrot? Because I want that.
They actually have kind of a little turmeric and a little, what's the other seasoning? Turmeric and salt, and then it's vinegar and sugar. So they're kind of sweet. And then I use a little jalapenos, like I'll simmer the sugar and vinegar water together with jalapenos and pour that over those carrots. And then they're kind of crunchy because, you know, they're raw carrots and they're only processed long enough to kind of seal the jar, about 20 minutes at the most. And so you've kind of got a crispy carrot that is hot and spicy. And then, of course, you can make them just like you do dill pickles. They're just another – well, you've seen that mix, garden mix in the store that has cauliflower and carrots.
Gardenaria?
Yeah, I could never, I can't pronounce some of those weird words, but.
I don't know that I just did either, but I know what you're talking about.
Yes, and so you can actually, okay, back to fermentation again. You can ferment any vegetable or combination of vegetables on your counter. And so carrots are one of the easiest things to ferment next to cucumbers and cabbage. So fermenting pickled carrots are really awesome. And I can get you that recipe too. So,
and you can make some pretty good desserts with carrots.
Oh, yeah. Let's not forget those people who have to hide their carrots in something sugary like carrot cake. I have two recipes for carrot cake. One is called golden carrot cake, where your carrots are blended with oil, and so you get like a soft orange sponge cake. Really good. And that's the best way to hide them, because the other carrot cake, of course, is got like grated carrots and raisins and nuts and cream cheese frosting, which is a must. And that's kind of a little more textural, and I love a good carrot cake. Oh, yummy. Or bars. And you can shred them and freeze them. You can slice them and freeze them. Of course, you have to blanch them first. But they're also good in soup, you guys. Like my husband has said to me many times, if someone told me 5 years ago or 10 years ago that I'd be eating carrot soup or squash soup, I would have never believed him. And yet it's one of his favorite, and it's a very simple thing to do.
Well, give us a sense of how simple it is.
Okay, so I come home from work. I go out and pick, you know, 4, 5, or 6 good-sized carrots, wash them, saute them in a little butter. Then I add a medium chopped onion. And, of course, you've got apples this time of year, too. So you want to throw in a couple of really fine apples. And by fine, I mean something like a Honeycrisp or a Windsap or a Gala, little tart, you know, and a stalk of celery that's been chopped up real fine. And you saute these vegetables till they're tender. And then you add a quart or a little more of chicken stock. And you can buy chicken stock at the store or you can make your own. It's conventional. It's organic. Adjust your seasoning. If you like something that has a little bit of that carrot cake flavor, you'll want to put a little nutmeg or cinnamon in with your salt and pepper. And then you can kind of eat it just the way it is. Or you can use a stick blender and puree it. Put it in a bowl, add some wonderful toasted sourdough breadcrumbs and a little swirl of sour cream. And you have just a, 30 minutes later, you have an absolutely wonderful harvest soup.
Well, bon appetit. We check in with Sue Balcom every week.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. And you guys try some carrot soup, will
you? Oh, I will.
What's happening is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Poplar's Music in Grand Forks, serving educational, church, and family music needs since 1909, and now offering the full line of Yamaha pianos and keyboards, in addition to many other instruments and music supplies. More info at poplarsmusic.com.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, it's late October. Halloween is looming, so we know that's what's going on, but there's other stuff as well. And Ashley Thornburg and I check out our list on the calendar every Thursday.
And I will start with Wynonna LaDuke speaking at the Hotel Donaldson. This is coming up on Saturday in Fargo. And Wynonna LaDuke is an environmentalist, an economist. She is a writer, and she has a new book out, and she will be reading from it and signing copies of the book, 6:30 to 8 p.m. Again, this is on Saturday at the Hodo in Fargo, 6:30 to 8 p.m., and it is no cover charge.
Rick Springfield is in concert Friday in Grand Forks at the Alaris Center. Grammy Award-winning singer Rick Springfield makes a stop, the creator of some of the finest power pop of the 80s. This Grammy-winning singer, songwriter, and musician has sold 25 million albums. His latest album, The Snake King, finds Springfield traveling down a dusty dirt road to explore the blues side of his rock and roll. The doors open at 7 at the Alaris Center on Friday. The show starts at 8 o'clock. The cost for tickets ranges from $43 to $68. Rick Springfield is in concert.
Deuces Wild Dueling Pianos, Friday and Saturday in Bismarck at the Bell Mayhus Center. These are a couple of pianists who are, if you've ever seen the dueling piano things, they set these two pianos side by side or even usually face to face, and then they just give you just a really high energy show. They usually throw in some comedy and audience participation. So Deuces Wild Dueling Pianos, Friday and Saturday in Bismarck at the Bell Mayhus, 8 to 11 p.m. Tickets are $28.
Well, here's another big concert. This one's in Fargo Friday evening. Nelly in concert at Shields Arena. Hip-hop star Nelly returns to the Shields Arena, where he made his local debut in March of 2011. The show will include Juvenile and Three United Empire as well. The Nelly show starts at 7:30. Tickets range from $30 to $100. Nelly is in concert Friday at the Shields Arena.
And in Moorhead, author P.S. Duffy is reading from her book, The Cartographer of No Man's Land. And this is tonight at the Knutson Campus Center. And again, this is at Concordia College. This is, every once in a while, they do this one community, one book, where they get lots of people together. It's like a book club where anybody in the town can participate, and then they bring in the author to do these discussions. This is at 7 o'clock at Concordia, and it's free. Author P.S. Duffy.
Well, let's talk about Halloween.
All right.
The Rocky Horror Picture Show, Friday. That's a staple, of course, in Fargo at the Fargo Theater. It's a Halloween classic, maybe even a tradition. The Fargo Theater features that Rocky Horror Picture Show with a late-night showing Friday night. There'll be a costume contest at 10:45 p.m. Participation and interaction are encouraged, but you are asked to not bring rice, lighters, hot dogs, and confetti. They do sell popcorn. 10:45 until much later Friday. That's the Rocky Horror Picture Show. It costs $5 to get in.
A night of Edgar Allan Poe readings this Friday in Williston at the James Memorial Arts Center. A night of chilling poetry and storytelling. Edgar Allan Poe, of course, certainly one of America's literary giants, and there will be a number of his poems and short stories that you can hear or even read. And there is even the opportunity for original writing. So any aspiring writers out there, bring this to a night of Edgar Allan Poe readings on Friday in Williston at the James Memorial Arts Center, $7 to $10. The event's free, but consider making a donation to the Arts Center while you're there.
I hope Dave Thompson is listening, because I'm about to give a pun here. Art Ghoulery Masquerade Reception in Friday in Moorhead at the Rourke Art Gallery. At Friday night, you can take in that Art Ghoulery Masquerade Reception. The institution celebrates the spookiest season with some frighteningly appropriate art, from the mysterious to the macabre. The show runs through November 4th with a costumed reception from 6:30 to 8 p.m. on Friday evening. It's free, and the hours from 6:30 to 8 o'clock.
The former governor's mansion is hosting a Halloween open house, and this is on Sunday the 28th from 1 to 4 p.m. It's free and open to the public. If kids are under 16, they do need to have an adult. The mansion will be all decorated for Halloween, and there's going to be stories and songs, and costumes are encouraged 1 to 4 on Sunday.
War of the Worlds, the panic broadcast. This is my pick because I love this story. I love H.G. Wells. I like the radio thing and all the commotion around that a long time ago. It's tonight through Sunday in Fargo at the stage at Island Park. An alien invasion throws humanity into chaos in this classic sci-fi. But it all took real-life panic in the streets when Orson Welles' 1938 radio adaptation, which some listeners took for the real thing. So this is the War of the Worlds, the panic broadcast, and it recreates the colorful events. It has the actual broadcast. It has commercials and lots of fun. So enjoy it. 7:30 in the evening tonight, Friday and Saturday. There's a Sunday matinee at 2 o'clock. It's $13 for students, $18 for senior citizens, $23 for the rest of the adults.
All right, and mine is the Entombed 12-hour mountain bike race Saturday at Turtle River State Park. This is Extreme North Dakota on its epic Halloween-themed bike race. So as much as you can get into a costume and be a hardcore biker, this goes from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. at Turtle River State Park on Saturday.
And that's what's happening.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 25th. Slope County, North Dakota, has just two towns, but this sparse part of the prairie once had more. Desart was one of them. Ora and Anna Desart homesteaded in the area southeast of Amadon in 1905. They had nine children. Two died as babies. The Desarts had come from Iowa, a Civil War family. Ora Desart had tried to join the Union Army at age 12, but was rejected. He had nine brothers and half-brothers who served in the war. The town of Desart had its roots in the farm post office that Ora Desart established on this date in 1906 and named after himself. In 1911, Postmaster Desart moved his post office 4 miles to the southeast. Up sprang a little town. The railroad was supposed to go through Desart, which attracted new businesses and people, but it was nearby Marmouth that boomed as the railroad town. About 75 people lived in Desart at its peak in 1920. Ora Desart's post office established two rural routes. The town had a store, bank, and dance hall. July 17th was designated as Desart Day, with a parade, horse races, ball games, and dancing. Ora Desart was an early mover and shaker and known as a speaker and a champion of local issues. He traveled all over Slope County to speak at public meetings, and he even advocated for the town of Bessie to become the county seat over Amadon. At one point, Amadon was the smallest county seat in the nation with about 20 residents. Ora Desart died in 1916 in Sioux Falls after surgery for cancer. The town of Desart, North Dakota, passed into history in the decades that followed. By 1960, only six people lived in Desart. The post office closed in 1955, with mail sent to Reeder, North Dakota. One of the last visible reminders of Desart is its cemetery, out along a dirt road south of Amadon and New England. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
If I did something wrong, do you know how quickly that would spread like wildfire across everything?
Larry Nassar was sentenced to up to 175 years in prison for sexually abusing more than 100 young athletes. Believed, a new NPR podcast, examines the case's big mystery. How did he get away with it for so long? Plus, the latest on suspicious package threats on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, when Montanans go to the polls, they'll choose a senator and a representative, and they'll see some interesting ballot measures. On Friday, we'll talk with Eric Whitney, news director for Montana Public Radio, and we'll also get our weekly analysis of North Dakota news from Dave Thompson. We'll also preview this Sunday's Prairie Public Presents, which is titled Rent and Frozen Pillows, How Bakken Housing Evolved with the Oil Boom. It was produced by Todd Melby and Amy Sisk. And we'll hear from Bob Dambach, Prairie Public's retiring director of television, and then Matt Olin will review First Man. We've got a busy Friday coming up on Main Street, and we hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.